me have men about me that are fat, Julius Caesar tells Mark Antony. Sleek-headed men, and such as sleep o' nights. Yond Cassius has a lean and hungry look. He thinks too much. Such men are dangerous. Welcome to the After Dinner Scholar from Wyoming Catholic College. I'm your host, Dr. Jim Tunkowicz. Cassius was indeed dangerous, as Caesar discovered, on the Ides of March, when a group of senators, led by Cassius, stabbed him to death. They, for their part, believed their actions represented the height of patriotism. Caesar, they believed, would be king, an abomination in the Roman Republic. Liberty, freedom, tyranny is dead, they shout as Caesar's blood drips from their knives and their hands. Were Cassius, Brutus, and the rest patriots or treasonous monsters? Dante, of course, puts Cassius and Brutus in the frozen bottom of hell, endlessly chewed by Satan, along with Judas Iscariot. What was Shakespeare's judgment on these men and their plot? And how should we look at the conspirators and their attempt to defend the Republic from what they perceived as tyranny? At the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, the college's Adult Learning Week this past June, most of those conversations took place in seminar sessions, but Dr. Pavlos Papadopoulos started us off with this introduction.
I'm going to introduce Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. I'm going to do it in a somewhat backed up way. I'm going to start in 1837 of all years, which I think has already been referenced in a previous lecture. And then I'm going to come to Caesar and to the play. On January 27th, 1837, at the Young Man's Lyceum of Springfield, Illinois, a 28-year-old lawyer named Abraham Lincoln delivered a speech on the subject, "The Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions." In it, the young Lincoln, then serving his second term in the Illinois House of Representatives, a full decade away from his one-term stint in the United States House of Representatives, two full decades away from the debates with Stephen Douglas that would bring him national political attention, warned against the breakdown of law and order, the rise of vigilante justice, and the specific dangers that these trends posed to Republican liberty. Praising the nation that was brought forth by the founders 61 years ago, doesn't quite have the same ring to it, but Lincoln argued that Americans need not fear some transatlantic military giant stepping across the ocean to crush us at a blow. Instead, he said, the danger that might arise would arise from within. As a nation of freemen, he said, we must live through all time or die by suicide. What does the suicide of a nation of free men look like? How does that happen? What are, as we like to say today, the root causes of the suicide of liberty? How can citizens of a republic recognize such a danger when it arises and perhaps resist it? This internal danger, Lincoln said, had two aspects. Its first aspect was the dangerous man himself, a man of talent and ambition. Not ordinary ambition, not the kind that is content with supporting and maintaining an edifice that has been erected by others, not the kind of ambition that is to be gratified by a seat in Congress, a gubernatorial or presidential chair. Lincoln spoke instead of men who belong to the family of the lion or the tribe of the eagle, men like an Alexander, a Caesar, or a Napoleon. Such towering genius, Lincoln said, disdains a beaten path. It sees no distinction in adding story to story upon the monuments of fame erected to the memory of others. It denies that it is glory enough to serve under any chief. It scorns to tread in the footsteps of any predecessor, however illustrious. It thirsts and burns for distinction, and if possible, it will have it, whether at the expense of emancipating slaves or enslaving freemen. Such a man of towering genius, of Caesar-like ambition, was one aspect of the danger, the most obvious aspect. The guard against it, Lincoln said, would be found in the people. If they managed to be united with one another attached to the government and laws, and generally intelligent to successfully frustrate his designs. The people, if they were united by a political religion and dedicated to a reverence for the laws, could resist such a tyrant. And here Lincoln indicated the second aspect of this homegrown threat to Republican government. The people, dedicated to the rule of law and the existing Republican Constitution, might be the guard against a Caesar figure. But the very same people, or rather a different people, a people who no longer deserved to be called citizens, but merely subjects, who would be appropriately described with reference to their jobs, maybe carpenter, cobbler, Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 1, rather than their nationality or membership in a body politic, a people who for one reason or another are no longer dedicated to the self-evident truths of their regime and its way of life, a people no longer united to their dedication to the rule of law and their own participation in ruling and being ruled, such a people would not merely fail to frustrate the designs of a Caesar figure, such a people would instead become part of the danger, serve as aiders and abettors of the man who belongs to the tribe, the family of the lion, and the tribe of the eagle, the new Alexander or Caesar or Napoleon, the man who thirsts and burns for distinction and will have it by hook or by crook, not by supporting an existing edifice, but by tearing it down and building a new one, this time one that is made in his own image and likeness. Why these three men? Why Alexander, Caesar, and Napoleon? All three, Lincoln said, possessed of the loftiest genius coupled with ambition sufficient to push it to its utmost stretch. Alexander is the great ancient example of a world conqueror and empire builder who ended the liberty of the Greek cities and conquered the seemingly unconquerable empires of the East. Napoleon is the great modern example of such a man, and in addition, one who transforms an unstable, spiraling revolution into a revolutionary expansionist state with himself at its head. Caesar, finally, is the enduring example of a man who transformed a long-standing but much decayed republic into a new regime, an empire, whose rulers would thereafter be called by his name. And not only in Rome. Caesar's name became the title for emperor, not only through the histories of the Eastern and Western Roman empires, but also the kings of the Franks, the heads of the Holy Roman Empire, the Tsars of Russia, the Kaisers of Germany, and, through the Russians, various ad hoc head honcho executive positions created in the US government in the last century. Industry Tsar, Drug Tsar, Terrorism Tsar, Cybersecurity Tsar, Coronavirus Tsar. I think Kamala Harris is going to be the Border Tsar. Now, a usage that first appeared in the early decades of the 20th century, and this is probably a bad sign, has increased in usage and familiarity ever since. So what is so special about Caesar? Why does Lincoln invoke him? Why does Caesar of all men give his name to the office of supreme autocratic ruler in Rome, Russia, and elsewhere? Why does Caesar of all men have a specific political phenomenon, Caesarism, named after him? Shakespeare's tragedy of Julius Caesar is helpful in answering these questions. And these questions, I hope, will be helpful for opening up the play to us. The first three acts of the play occur in 44 BC, the year of Caesar's assassination, shortly after his senatorially established tenure as dictator in perpetuity, which seems to be cut short by his death, but perhaps instead is ensured by his death. Whereas Shakespeare's Coriolanus depicts the tensions in the Roman Republic shortly after its foundation, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar depicts the tensions within the Republic before and during its destruction. These tensions are present above all in the character of Brutus. I think we must explore Brutus's motivations for joining the conspiracy against Caesar and in directing it in the specific way that he does direct it in order to understand the apparent subject of the play, the man whose name appears in its title, the man who says very little and seemingly little of consequence, despite the fact that this is apparently his tragedy, despite the fact that his name is on everyone's lips on almost every page. I read a scholar, I haven't gone and checked this myself, but I read a scholar who said that the name of Caesar appears more often than any other proper name in all of Shakespeare's corpus. just from this play itself, the number of times Caesar is named exceeds any other, Hamlet, Macbeth, whatever, any other character's name in the corpus. One of the questions that I'm sort of larger questions I'm interested in is why it's called the Tragedy of Julius Caesar, whether that's an appropriate name. You might think just looking at the content, it should be called the Tragedy of Marcus Brutus. So whether that's appropriate, and if so, how, something we might take up later. I mentioned Caesar as the namesake not only of certain political offices, but of an entire political phenomenon, Caesarism. This is the handout. I'd like to turn now to this handout. I do so to help us evaluate Brutus. My questions, of course, are Brutus's decisions in the play sound or unsound, prudent or imprudent? Insofar as they are political decisions, I think we need to evaluate them as political decisions, not merely personal, private decisions, not solely moral decisions, although we can say that something he does is moral or immoral, but I think if we leave it at that level, we will not understand what is actually occurring in the play. These are decisions, Brutus's decisions, have an unavoidably public dimension to them. Both in Brutus's reasoning and his presentation of his reasoning, there may be a distinction there in some cases, and in the consequences of these decisions. So insofar as Brutus's decisions are political decisions of the highest order, in effect, he's deciding that Rome needs a regime change, right? If you kill this one man, you will change the regime of Rome. And that change should be accomplished by stabbing Caesar. For all these reasons, in order to evaluate Brutus's decision to join the conspiracy, we need to understand the situation of the Roman regime at the time of Caesar's perpetual dictatorship. So this handout has two sides. There's some selections from Plutarch on the back, which I'm not going to go through right now. And then there's one that I've labeled, What is Caesarism? These are excerpts from a work by the 20th century political philosopher Leo Strauss. He is in correspondence with other thinkers on the topic of tyranny, and here he is describing something called Caesarism and distinguishing it from tyranny.
When calling a given regime tyrannical, we imply that constitutional government is a viable alternative to it. But Caesarism emerges only after the final breakdown of the Republican constitutional order. Hence, Caesarism, or post-constitutional rule, cannot be understood as a subdivision of tyranny in the classic sense of tyranny. Caesarism is still a subdivision of absolute monarchy, as the classics understood it. If, in a given situation, the Republican constitutional order has completely broken down, there is no reasonable prospect of its being restored within all the foreseeable future. The establishment of permanent absolute rule cannot, as such, be justly blamed. Therefore, it is fundamentally different from the establishment of tyranny. Just blame could attach only to the matter in which that permanent absolute rule that is truly necessary is established and exercised. Caesarism is then essentially related to a corrupt people, to a low level of political life, to a decline of society. It presupposes the decline, if not the extinction, of civic virtue or of public spirit, and it necessarily perpetuates that condition. Caesarism belongs to a degraded society, and it thrives on its degradation. Caesarism is just, whereas tyranny is unjust. But Caesarism is just in the way in which deserved punishment is just. It is as little choice worthy for its own sake as is deserved punishment. Cato refused to see what his time demanded because he saw too clearly the degraded and degrading character of what his time demanded. It is much more important to realize the low level of Caesarism, for, to repeat, Caesarism cannot be divorced from the society which deserves Caesarism, than to realize that under certain conditions, Caesarism is necessary and hence legitimate. While the classics were perfectly capable of doing justice to the merits of Caesarism, they were not particularly concerned with elaborating a doctrine of Caesarism, since they were primarily concerned with the best regime. They paid little attention to post-constitutional rule or to late kingship, than to pre-constitutional rule or to early kingship. Rustic simplicity is a better soil for the good life than is sophisticated rottenness. But there was another reason which induced the classics to be almost silent about post-constitutional rule: to stress the fact that it is just to replace constitutional rule by absolute rule, if the common good requires that change, means to cast a doubt on the absolute sanctity of the established constitutional order. It means encouraging dangerous men to confuse the issue by bringing about a state of affairs in which the common good requires the establishment of their absolute rule. The true doctrine of the legitimacy of Caesarism is a dangerous doctrine. The true distinction between Caesarism and tyranny is too subtle for ordinary political use. It is better for the people to remain ignorant of that distinction and to regard the potential Caesar as a tyrant. No harm can come from this theoretical error, which becomes a practical truth if the people have the mettle to act upon it. No harm can come from the political identification of Caesarism and tyranny. Caesars can take care of themselves.
So there's a few claims in this excerpt from Strauss. I'd like to indicate them and ask how they are illustrated or not illustrated by what we've seen in Shakespeare's play thus far. So I'm going to make a few comments, but then I'd like to also go back and forth and see if there are moments in the play, especially from the first three acts, where you see this resonating or see this illustrated. First, Strauss describes Caesarism as a situationally specific subdivision of absolute monarchy. It is permanent absolute rule that arises after the final breakdown of a republican constitutional order. So Caesarism is the permanent, absolute, but also post-constitutional rule. It's not just any old permanent absolute rule, but in a specific context, after a republic has decayed past the point of being revivified. As he says later, Caesarism belongs to a degraded society, to a sophisticated and rotten society, not to a rustic and simple society. So Rome was a republic with a republican constitutional order, which has, by the mid-first century BC, fallen into some amount of disrepair. Is this illustrated in the play? Do we see this in the play? Where do we see Rome appearing to be post-constitutional? In other words, where do we see Rome no longer being capable of functioning as a republic? Not just because one man has stepped in and usurped the office of dictator for an extended period of time, but even if you take that man out, it would be incapable of ruling itself. Yeah, so again, in the centuries leading up to this moment, really in the third and second century BC, Rome was at its height as a republic. During the Punic Wars, the great contest between Rome and Carthage, we really see Rome develop itself, this mixed regime, which Coriolanus is so ambivalent about, where the people have a say in representation and protection, and also the few, the nobility, have representation and a say and influence over the regime. There are these enduring tensions in Rome between the different social classes, but during the Punic Wars, when Rome is slowly defeating Carthage over the course of three separate wars, taking Sicily, taking Iberia, and then finally in the Third Punic War, taking Africa and destroying Carthage once and for all, you see Roman leaders really channeling their own ambition to the common good. The reason the Republic functions for as long as it does is because there is always the opportunity for a man of great ambition to win extraordinary honor by serving Rome. And then with the Third Punic War, Carthage is finally destroyed. One of the statesmen at the time, so famously Cato says, "Moreover, I am of the opinion that Carthage must be destroyed." And every speech he gives in the Senate, it doesn't matter what he's talking about. He says, he ends with, by the way, let's destroy Carthage. He could be talking about anything that has nothing to do with Carthage. But there's another statesman at the time, Scipio Nasica, who Plutarch describes, who says, actually, Carthage should not be destroyed, even though we fought two devastating wars with them. Actually, Carthage should not be destroyed. We should keep an enemy around. It's helpful to our internal virtue to have an enemy because it keeps us on our toes and it keeps us away from each other's throats. And if we destroy Carthage, and Carthage is the last major power in the Western Mediterranean besides Rome at this time, if we destroy Carthage, we are going to enjoy its bounty. We're going to enjoy its luxury. We're going to become corrupt. The Republic is going to become decadent, and we are going to turn against each other. And he is ignored. Carthage is destroyed. And then we get the century or two process of turning into the Roman Empire, which culminates with Caesar. Okay, another observation about the Strauss handout. Strauss concludes that Caesarism is distinct from tyranny. Right? It's permanent absolute rule arising in a post-constitutional situation, and it's therefore distinct from tyranny. Strauss maintains that the manner in which this permanent absolute rule that is truly necessary is established and exercised, that the way in which it's established and exercised should and must affect our evaluation of it. So Caesarism as such is not tyrannical, but permanent absolute rule established in a post-constitutional situation might be tyrannical, right? So you could find yourself in this situation and establish or exercise your rule as a tyrant would, or you could find yourself in this situation and instead become a Caesar. So there's some kind of distinction between Caesar and tyrant, although that's not the way he's talked about typically. The accusation is always Caesar is a tyrant or Caesar is going to be a tyrant. He's like a serpent's egg, right? As Brutus says. So what in the play do we learn about Caesar's way of establishing and exercising his rule? Of course, the focus of the play is not on his rise to power, but Shakespeare has given us moments where we get glimpses of how he establishes rule and how he is currently exercising it. For example, consider how he has treated his former enemies and rivals thus far. All these guys who wind up being part of the conspiracy, who are on Pompey's side against him, and then he defeated Pompey, on the Senate's side against Caesar, and then he defeated them. Consider also whether he does what tyrants always do, which is maintain a bodyguard. He doesn't. Right? We don't see Caesar marching around with a bunch of men with swords at their sides surrounding him, protecting him. He doesn't have the Secret Service or something like that. Right? So what I'm asking is, do we see Caesar appearing as a tyrant in his actions, in his words, in his intentions, in his ambitions? Why or on the basis of what do the conspirators see him as a tyrant or say that he is a tyrant? Tyranny is the kind of rule, the rule that a master would exercise over slaves, but in this case, the people who are being treated as slaves are actually capable of freedom. They're just being repressed now. As opposed to, we might have to come up with some different term for treating people like slaves, but they themselves are incapable of ruling themselves. And so in a way, it's what they deserve. So the way that Strauss distinguishes them, there are two things to consider. One is the manner in which the rule is exercised or established. And that might be going back to the question of force. The other thing that distinguishes tyranny from Caesarism, as Strauss describes it, is the incapacity of the people to rule themselves, or the kind of exhaustion of the free constitutional regime that did exist. I completely agree that Caesar is wily, that Caesar is eroding and continuing to erode what is there in terms of Roman capacity for self-government. But then there are still two questions. One, let me just say the C word, his clemency, right? How does he treat his enemies? Maybe this isn't decisive for him being a tyrant or something else, but Brutus and all of these other fellows were opposed to him, and he has given them, he has tolerated them and also given them offices. I mean, they're nominal offices. They don't really mean anything anymore. He's the only one who wields any power. He's dictator in perpetuity. He hasn't dissolved the Senate. He still keeps it around. He calls it his Senate. And he says that my will should suffice for the Senate because I will it. Nevertheless, there is a kind of gentleness in the way that he exercises his rule. That itself does not mean it's good rule or that it's the right, it's right, but there's a softness there that is not, that we do not normally associate with tyrants. The other question is, what do we see from the play about the people's capacity or incapacity to rule themselves? And here I think it's interesting to distinguish between what we might see as Brutus's mistakes and what we could imagine happening if Brutus had taken a different course. Perhaps Brutus does not do everything he should have done in terms of preparing for the aftermath of the death of Caesar. But so let's say he had. What would that have looked like? Would the people have been capable of being ruled in a free manner?
The struggle at the end of the Roman Republic resulted in civil war, as the armies of Octavius, whom we know as Augustus Caesar, and the armies of Mark Antony, Julius Caesar's right hand and Cleopatra's lover, battle one another for supremacy of what was no longer a republic, but an empire. Next week, we'll take up that story as we consider Shakespeare's play, Antony and Cleopatra. Why not give it a read this week in preparation? If you're wondering what might have gone on in those seminar discussions at the Wyoming School of Catholic Thought, let me encourage you to mark your calendar for the 2022 Wyoming School. The tentative dates are Sunday, June 12th through Friday, June 17th. For Wyoming Catholic College, this is Dr. Jim Tonkowicz.